three, four, five, six. Thank you. Well, as I was walking into the class today, several of you asked me to comment on this NASA bacteria. Unfortunately, somebody actually handed me the article, because I've been in Toronto the last couple of days and wasn't aware that this thing had actually happened. Not too surprising, it just got announced yesterday. But I've not yet read the peer-reviewed article, and they're also promising at least a half dozen articles critiquing the find. But what they're actually claiming is that they have found evidence for life in a micrometeorite. It's a C1 carbonaceous chondrite meteorite. And then they also show a little photo of a bacterium that they claim to have found inside the meteorite. And now, before I give any serious comment, and I'd actually like to read the article. It's published. It's in the Journal of Cosmology. I'm surprised it got published in that journal, but maybe there's reasons. This afternoon, I'm actually going to read the article and see what's going on. But they have yet to publish the articles that are critiquing it. And what they did, and it's kind of unprecedented, is that they actually sent the article out to several hundred scientists in advance of publication so that they'd be ready to publish the critiques fairly quickly. And I think this is because of what happened with AOH-84001. That's that 4-pound meteorite that President Bill Clinton did a little dance around in front of national television celebrating the discovery of life in this meteorite that came from Mars. And then after a couple of years went by, they said, well, it's not life. So this may be a little different in that what they were finding in AOH-84001 were extremely small fossils. What they're finding in this one looks like a really giant fossil. And later proved that it wasn't biological at all. What they're finding in this is something that's about 25 microns across. Microns. There are some that are so big you can see with the naked eye. This one is a substantial size. That's going to raise some suspicion right away. Did this meteorite get contaminated by Earth life? But what they're saying in the article is they see features in this fossil that look different from other fossils that we can routinely identify here on Earth. So the claim is this really is alien life. I'm going to be interested just to see what the critiques are saying and also read the article itself. Because these C1 carbonaceous meteorites typically are primitive meteorites. What we mean by that is they're meteorites before planets really existed. And if that's the case, then this can't possibly be evidence for life. It's got to be contamination if it's evidence for life at all. But it'll be interesting to see exactly what kind of evidence they have on the meteorite. What they claim to do is they found this meteorite, they cracked it open, and inside they found these fossils. So in order for anything like that to be able to survive, it'd have to be at least 2 meters across with no cracks in it. So it'll be interesting to see what the size of it. Can't believe that it's anywhere near that big. There's only a handful of meteorites that have been found that are that size, and they typically have cracks in it anyway. So that'd be one thing to do, is actually study the meteorite, see if they got a date for it, and see if they can identify where it came from. We do get meteorites that come. Yes, this is going in and out. I noticed. Did you get your hand up?
No. You mentioned before that you believe that you will find evidence of Earth life on the Moon and Mars.
Right.
Is it possible that this is Earth life from previous that got picked up into?
Well, that's a possibility. I mean, we need to find out where this meteorite came from. Did it come from? Is it really a primitive meteorite? In which case, we can discount right away that this is evidence for life. That'd be far too early. Or is it a meteorite that came from the Moon or came from Mars? That would lead you down a different research path. Having read what I've seen here, we just don't know. I mean, it'd be interesting to read the peer-reviewed article and actually see what kind of research they've done on the meteorite. And that was key for ALH84001, was the research they did on the meteorite as opposed to looking at the so-called fossils. So that'd be probably the first line of critique I would recommend, is actually study the meteorite, see what's going on, what's the origin of the meteorite, what's the date of the meteorite, and see if they can find what happened when it through the atmosphere. I mean, one of the other things that makes it suspicious is when a meteorite goes through the atmosphere, it gets heated up. And unless this thing is really big, 2 meters plus, and then you're going to get the destruction taking place. And this thing looks pretty intact. So, and then another line of research is, okay, is this really a fossil evidence for life? Or are we really seeing something that looks like a fossil evidence for life? But they are promising that within the next few weeks, there will be at least a half dozen papers published critiquing the find. And so, it'll be interesting just to see what they come up with. But if it's anything like ALH84001, it'll be about 2 years before we know what's really going on. It usually takes that long to sift through it all. I see several hands. I mean, some of you know more about this than I do. We have a biologist in the back. What's your comment? Well, that's actually what I'm going to be talking about this morning, is the fact that we would expect the fossils of Earth's first life to be on the surface of the moon and even on Mars. And if the meteorite came from that location, we may actually have in this find fossil evidence of Earth's first life, which would make it a very exciting discovery. So, but based on what I've read so far, there's a lot of questions. And so that's about as far as I'm going to take it. But I'm just saying these are some suggested lines of critique and study, and let's see what comes out of this. John.
I just wondered, in general, if any fraction of these meteorites that could have been debris from recent impacts, the last billion years, that were ejected at slightly below escape velocity, went into high orbits, and eventually stayed in the manner.
Well, again, we need to figure out what this meteorite is all about. But your typical C1 carbonaceous meteorite is about 4.57 billion years old, and the belief is that this is the building blocks of the planets. So if it really is one of these pristine primitive meteorites, then this can't be evidence for life. It's got to have some other explanation, but it may not be. Maybe it's a meteorite that got transported from another solar system body, which could lead to a number of very interesting deductions. So we'll see. Yes?
Will they likely be able to tell where it came from?
Well, that's what I'd like to do, is actually read the paper, see what they know about the meteorite. I mean, having read this, I don't know the size of the meteorite. I don't know the date of the meteorite. I don't know the structure of the meteorite. I mean, if this thing is porous and it's got cracks in it, that again would be evidence that this can't be the claimed fossil evidence that they're claiming. But if this is a solid rock and it's of sufficient size, I mean, those are the questions we need to address. And also, what's the chemistry of the meteorite? I mean, that was a huge factor with ALH84001, is when they analyzed the chemistry of the rock, they found that this could generate by inorganic chemical pathways the structures that they were identifying as microfossils of life. So, that kind of analysis would be important as well. I expect that these critique papers that are coming out are going to actually get into all that stuff. But, what I'm reading so far, that's not there. And I'm suspicious that the journal, peer-reviewed journal, is not going to have a lot of data on the meteorite. It sounds like their whole focus is on imaging the fossils. And they found a claim, by the way, they found several, not just one. So the claim is that they have several of these fossils of different kinds showing a variety of different species. That's interesting to me, because if this really is Earth's first life being transported back to Earth, then this would be evidence that Earth's first life was multi-species rather than a single species, and that would be very insightful in terms of testing different creation evolution models. But, I mean, right now I'm speculating. I just don't know. Yeah, Al.
Hasn't there been other meteorites that have been found with fossils on it?
Only one that they've ever suggested evidence for fossil life in it was that AOH-84001 discovered during the Clinton era. But after 2 years of research, there was a consensus that this was not evidence for life. So this would really, I mean, if this proves to be real, it would be the first evidence of any fossilized life found in a meteorite. Just because of the way first life has been transported throughout the solar system. In fact, a research paper got published in Icarus, the journal Icarus, by a Christian and two agnostic astronomers, making the point that at the time of the origin of life on planet Earth, there had been very efficient transport of Earth's life into the interplanetary medium, and that there should be a probability that this stuff would fall back onto the Earth. And they were suggesting this is one way to find the fossils of Earth's first life. This may be in that category. So it'll be interesting, again, to see how this all plays out. Okay, there are no more questions. So I'll jump into where we plan to take off. And what we've been doing the past few weeks is looking at the problem of the origin of the first life on planet Earth. And if you missed the sessions we've had, we spent some time showing why the scientific community is now convinced from a naturalistic perspective that the origin of life did not happen on planet Earth, and which is why they immediately went and said, well, origin of life took place on Mars, and then that life got transported from Mars to the Earth by meteoritic transport, kind of along the lines of what we're seeing right here. So that's why they say the origin of life happened on Earth. It happened first on Mars, got transported from Mars to Earth, and that explains the origin of life on Earth. Yes?
Excuse me. Do they reach that conclusion of that it didn't start on Earth simply because of the timeline, the difficulty with the timeline?
Well, as we reviewed here in the class, that's one aspect, is that with the evidence from the late heavy bombardment, the window of time for the origin of life is immeasurably small. And then the fact, and I think it was most convincing, is that we can now demonstrate that Earth never had a prebiotic soup. So if you have no prebiotics and very little time, and the third factor was Earth is not an environment which would allow for the possibility of homochiral amino acids or homochiral pentose sugars. And so if there's no mechanism to make all these amino acids left-handed, and the pentose sugars right-handed, and if there is no prebiotic chemicals to start with in a measurably short time, then that would rule out Earth as a site for the origin of life by a naturalistic means. It doesn't rule it out from a supernatural perspective, but it would rule out a naturalistic pathway for the origin of life, which is what really launched astrobiology, the study of life in outer space. And the first place they looked was Mars, saying Mars is the place where maybe it happened.
So it's more of a second choice, more of an escape route than it is a positive argument.
Well, yes, it is. I mean, it's based on a negative argument in the sense that the evidence tells us it couldn't have happened on the Earth from a naturalistic perspective. It must have happened somewhere else and got transported to the Earth. And so the argument was the life originated on Mars, and then meteoritic impacts transported that life from Mars to the Earth. Now, of course, it could go the other way around, where you have God creating life on the Earth, and then that life being transported from Earth to the surface of Mars. So on that basis, you would conclude, regardless of your theological perspective, that the remains of life will be found on Mars. Because after all, we know that life was abundant on the Earth 3.8 billion years ago. We have chemical isotope evidence that demonstrates, I've reviewed it, we've got the uranium evidence and the isotope evidence by three different isotope pathways that prove that life was abundant on the Earth as far back as 3.83 billion years ago. And between 3.5 and 3.8 billion years ago, Earth was being impacted by big meteors. And that would cause material to leave the Earth and be transported to Mars. So, again, whether you're an atheist, a Christian, an agnostic, a deist, it doesn't matter. we would expect on that basis alone that we're going to find the remains of life on Mars, but it would be Earth transport of life. And so the real goal of going to Mars, I mean, there's many within NASA and JPL that are convinced that we're going to find indigenous life on Mars, but that leads to another research step. When you find the remains of life on Mars, we would need to do experiments to show that it's Earth-transported life as opposed to indigenous life. Now, if it's indigenous life, one way you could prove that, for example, if the pentose sugars were left-handed and the amino acids were right-handed, because all the life we see on planet Earth has right-handed pentose sugars and left-handed amino acids. So if you find it the reverse, then you could conclude that these remains of Mars really are indigenous to Mars. They're not from the Earth. However, if we're seeing the same kinds of protein structures and DNA and RNA that we see on the Earth, and it's all based on left-handed amino acids and right-handed pentose sugars, then we could rightly conclude that these remains we're finding on Mars are from the Earth. They're not indigenous. But this is something that the lay public is not aware of, is that it's inevitable we will find the remains of life on Mars. It's got to be there. Now, it doesn't mean it's going to be easy to find, but it will be there. And one reason why, if we're talking Earth-transported life, we're looking at about 200 pounds of Earth material per 100 square kilometer surface of the Mars. So that means it's going to be difficult to find the remains of life. Now, shouldn't be that difficult, because 1 ton of Earth soil contains 10 to the 17 bacteria. It's 100,000 trillion bacteria in every ton of Earth soil. And so having that distributed over the surface of Mars, we'd expect that some parts of Mars are going to have a lot more Earth material than other parts. So if we actually do really, you know, put a lot of money into scouring the surface of Mars, it really is only a matter of time till we find the remains of life on Mars. Yes?
It seems to me that all this crashing and bumping into each other, all these, the solar system and every other place in the universe, that has to be more or less, you know, the norm, that every one of these planets and rocks circling around would have some kind of life, you know.
Well, we're on record, Al, as predicting ever since 1988 that we will find the remains of Earth life on virtually every solar system body, just because of how efficiently Earth life was transported to the rest of the solar system between 3.5 and 3.8 billion years ago. Now, what makes this interesting from a biblical perspective is we have no fossils of Earth's first life that date earlier than 3.47 billion years old. Those are the oldest fossils we have in the face of the Earth. And there's no hope of finding fossils older than 3.47 billion years on the Earth. And it's because Earth has had such aggressive plate tectonic and erosion forces in operation. Those fossils have been destroyed. On the other hand, the fossils of Earth's first life that got transported away from the Earth would not be subject to the Earth's aggressive erosion and plate tectonics. So the best place to find the fossils of Earth's first life is not on the Earth. That's impossible. The best place is to find them elsewhere in the solar system. And so this kind of a research study is exciting to me, because we may actually have here, possibly, evidence of the fossils of Earth's first life, or close to the beginning of life here on planet Earth. But I would argue that Mars is probably not the best place to look in the solar system. And it's because the meteors that would have transported Earth's soil from the Earth to Mars, when they come into Mars, are going to be hitting at high velocities. And because they're hitting at high velocities, they're probably going to be broken down into unrecognizable pieces. I mean, what we're probably going to be forced to do on Mars is to find isotope signatures of Earth's first life. But hey, that's what we already have here on planet Earth. We do have the chemical evidence, we just don't have the fossils. But, in terms of the calculations that have been done of the impacts of Earth-transported meteors to Mars, it looks like the impact velocities are going to be too high. Mars doesn't have much of an atmosphere, and so these things come in at high velocity, and when they hit the surface of the Earth, it's going to do a lot of damage to the fossils of Earth's first life. But one of the things I want to address before we get into that question is why we can rule out Mars as a site for indigenous life. Why the origin of life, from a naturalistic perspective, can't happen on the surface of Mars. And the first reason is, just like with Earth, we have very little time. We can't measure a significant window of time. And that's because Mars was subjected to the same late heavy bombardment as the Earth was. And so just like Earth was quickly put into a very high temperature state, which would have broken down all these prebiotic molecules, the same thing would have happened on Mars. Now, Mars didn't take the damage that the Earth did, but we can calculate that it took sufficient damage that it would mean that an origin of life on Mars would not have measurable time to take place. And something that's unique to Mars that we don't see on the Earth is that Mars would experience a carbonate crisis. The speculation for life on Mars is based on the fact that if you go early enough in the history of Mars, it might have been wet and warm. There would have been a lot more water being transported to Mars early in the history of the solar system, because it would be picking up a lot of comet collisions, and comets are 80 to 85% frozen water. And so four and a half billion years ago, Mars was getting a lot more comet delivery than it is now. So that means you could have a possibility of a wet Mars. And if you have enough of an atmosphere, say there's a primordial atmosphere of Mars that would be a lot thicker than what it has today, then that leads to the possibility that it might be wet and warm. If it's wet and warm, you might have life. But the problem is, it's ruled out by the carbonate crisis. If Mars ever had a warm, wet condition, those warm, wet conditions would cause the carbon dioxide on Mars. Say, why carbon dioxide? It's the only way to keep the planet warm. Mars would only be warm if it had a thick carbon dioxide atmosphere. That would trap enough heat from the sun to keep it warm. But if you got that much carbon dioxide and you got the water will react with the carbon dioxide to make carbonates. And the problem with Mars is it doesn't have the plate tectonic activity that Earth does. By the way, this also happens on Earth. Water reacts with carbon dioxide to make carbonates. But because of plate tectonics, those carbonates get converted back to carbon dioxide when volcanoes erupt. And so there's a cycle going on in the Earth where you got water under warm, wet conditions reacting with carbon dioxide to make carbonates, getting trapped into the crust of the Earth. But once in the crust of the Earth, plate tectonic activity, earthquakes, and volcanoes breaks that down and releases the water and carbon dioxide back to the surface environment. The problem is that doesn't happen on Mars. And that's why when you go to the surface of Mars, you see carbonates everywhere. And then also a thing that we note is that the craters on Mars do not show much erosion. If you have warm, wet conditions on Mars at any time in its past history, that speeds up the erosion rate by almost a factor of 100 times. And what we're seeing on Mars is that the craters show a level of erosion that testifies that Mars has never had a wet, warm environment. Moreover, we have AOH-84001. It's a 4-pound meteorite that we know came from Mars, and it's more than 4 billion years old. It's been dated at about 4.4 billion years, but it has zero evidence of any significant water throughout those 4.4 billion years. So I would indicate by two lines of evidence that Mars has been permanently dry and cold. And just like the Earth, you'd have the same oxygen ultraviolet crisis. If you got oxygen in the Martian environment, that will stop prebiotic chemistry. If you don't have oxygen, ultraviolet radiation from the sun streams through, and that stops prebiotic chemistry. So if you don't have prebiotics and you don't have time, there's no possibility for the origin of life. By the way, it's different on Mars than it is on the Earth. We know the early Earth had oxygen a sufficient quantity to stop prebiotic chemistry. What we see on Mars is the reverse. It didn't have oxygen, which means the ultraviolet radiation would have come through, and it would come through a lot more intense than it would on the Earth, because Mars did not have a significant atmosphere to blunt much of the ultraviolet radiation coming in. And so this by itself establishes the origin of life could not have happened on planet Earth by a naturalistic pathway. And likewise, there's no possible physical or chemical source to drive all the amino acids to a left-handed configuration and the pentose sugars to a right-handed configuration. And incidentally, we've yet to find any evidence for amino acids, nucleotides, or sugars on the surface of Mars. So it has zero chemical evidence for even the building blocks, let alone the homochirality. And so today there's a consensus that the origin of life did not happen by a naturalistic pathway on Mars, which means if we find indigenous life on Mars, you'd conclude it must be from the hand of God. But then that raises a question, why would God make primitive life on Mars in the first place? I leave that to the theologians to debate. Okay, go ahead.
I'm wondering, was at one time some flow of apparently liquid water on Mars?
Yeah, you will get liquid water flows. Okay. The reason why we see evidence for liquid water flows on Mars is that water does accumulate on the poles of Mars because of comet delivery. So if a comet lands at any of the poles of Mars, that water will remain in a frozen state because it's just too cold on the poles of Mars for water to evaporate. By the way, on Mars, the boiling point of water is identical to the freezing point. So that's one reason why when you get liquid water on Mars, it doesn't stay liquid for very long. It'll evaporate within a few seconds. Even if you get a large flow of water, it evaporates that quickly and disappears to outer space. Now, unlike Earth, the rotation axis of Mars is not stable. It flips back and forth, and it can flip back and forth by at least 60 degrees. And this happens probably on the order of once every million years or so, or tens of millions of years, which means that you'll have Mars where you've got water gradually accumulating at the poles. And by the way, we do have evidence for frozen water both the north and south pole of Mars. NASA and the European satellites have proven that the frozen water exists there. The problem is that when the rotation axis of Mars tilts away, then all that frozen water gets exposed to warmer temperatures and immediately evaporates. Now, if the temperature hits dramatically, you will get a few seconds of liquid water. And so this will cause the frozen water that was trapped at the pole, now that the rotation axis tilts, there's a possibility that frozen water could melt into a liquid form and cause a destructive water flow before all the water evaporates. And we found evidence on Mars of these eroded flows. Some have suggested it might be dust-induced as opposed to water-induced. But the consensus now is probably the majority are dust-induced, but some would be water-induced. But the evidence of the water-induced flow channels is that the liquid water was there for a very short period of time, which would be consistent with the fact that the boiling point and the freezing point of water on Mars are one and the same.
Talking thousands of years of existence or millions of years for liquid water?
Oh, for how long the liquid water lasts? No, I'm talking seconds. Within a few seconds, the liquid water will evaporate and dissipate to outer space. And so, but, I mean, if you get a large chunk of frozen water that gets suddenly warmed up, you will get a few seconds where it could remain in liquid form and cause a flow pattern. And as I say, the flow channels that we're finding are consistent with a very rapid, short-lived flow. So, and again, that fits everything we know about the physics of Mars. That if you ever get, and by the way, if you've got a small amount of ice that liquefies, it's actually less than a second before it disappears. But if you get a big chunk of ice, that gets exposed to warm temperature, you actually can get a significant liquid water flow, but extremely short-lived. So, and we're talking a few seconds. Obviously, that's not going to be of any benefit to a life form. Yes?
If indeed there was life on Earth before the late heavy bombardment, and the late heavy bombardment transported that to Mars, it seems we won't be able to know that it originated on Earth, because the bombardment erased all evidence of life on Earth prior, and we won't know if it was Homo chiral or anything. We won't be able to say, aha, there's a marker from this stuff on Mars that's...
Well, you're raising a very interesting point, because we do have evidence from zircons that there are brief windows of time before the late heavy bombardment. By the way, late heavy bombardment peaks at 3.88, 3.87 billion years ago. And this is an event where the Earth received tens of thousands of big comets and asteroids bombarding the Earth, which basically would have turned the surface of the Earth into liquid molten lava, obviously breaking down any molecules that could be of any benefit to the origin of life. However, we have some zircons that tell us that there are brief windows of time before the late heavy bombardment, as far back as 4.4 billion years, where you have brief episodes where you got liquid water and solid rocks, which is one reason why Fuzz Ron and I titled our book Origins of Life, because we wanted to leave open the possibility that perhaps God saw fit to have several origins of life previous to the late heavy bombardment, and then a really aggressive origin of life right after the late heavy bombardment. And you say, why would God want to do that? Well, the creation of life begins the chemical transformation of the atmosphere and the surface of the Earth. And it's quite possible that from God's perspective, he wanted to jumpstart things. And so even though the life that he would create might only last for a few hundred thousand years, he went ahead anyway, because that would begin the chemical transformation process. And it's possible that there may be as many as 10 brief episodes before the late heavy bombardment, between, say, 4.4 and 4.0 billion years, where the Creator could have stepped in and created life that would last for, say, several tens of thousands of years. And that may have given enough of a jump start in the chemical transformation that when you come to 3.83 billion years, now the Creator can step in and create many different species at a significant quantity level for life. And so the whole question is, does God need the chemical jumpstart, or is it not necessary at all? And that question, we simply don't know. But it leaves open this possibility. Maybe God created life as early as 4.4 billion years ago on the Earth, and of course that evidence would be completely destroyed by the late heavy bombardment. It's possible at 4.4 billion years, a meteor transported that very early life on Earth to Mars, to the Moon, or to some other solar system body, or maybe into the interstellar medium, and maybe that stuff can be returned to the Earth, like this paper is suggesting, or maybe we can actually go to these solar system bodies and find it. So it wouldn't be a shock to me if we find the remains of life on a solar system body besides the Earth that actually dates to be 4.2 or 4.4 billion years. In fact, the only way we can prove whether or not God would do that is to actually go to these solar system bodies and look for it. So, in that sense, I think as Christians, we have to be open to a degree as to exactly what kind of origin of life model we develop. There's a lot of unanswered questions we can't pin down, and we won't be able to pin them down until we actually go to these bodies and do a diligent search for the fossils of Earth's first life. Again, that can't be done on the surface of the Earth, but it can be done in these other solar system bodies. For that reason alone, I encourage you to keep supporting NASA with your tax dollars. So, question here.
You mentioned zircons, but you didn't explain what role they play in this. Are these such heavy and dense objects that they could survive the heavy bombardment? And
that's exactly right. Zircons can survive the late heavy bombardment.
And if so, could there not be some life embedded in those zircons.
That's a possibility. But the zircons they're finding are small. I mean, you need a really big zircon to have any hope of finding fossil evidence of Earth's first life. But what they are hoping to do with these zircon studies, this is ongoing research, is to look at these zircons that come from 4.0 to 4.4 billion years back in Earth's history and see if they can find an isotope signature of Earth's first life. And, that could prove whether or not life was present on Earth before the late heavy bombardment. That research is ongoing, so we don't have any results yet.
That's still an open question as to whether...
Well, here's... Yeah. The problem is we only have a handful of zircons that date that early. So, I mean, you would need a lot of zircons. And so there's actually a diligent search going on to find really ancient zircons. And if we find enough of them, especially if we find some that are significant size, then we could actually do that kind of isotope search and see whether or not it gives any evidence for life predating the late heavy bombardment. So this is a very active area of research. I mean, there's a lot that can go on. But let me shift gears here and suggest that a much better place to go to do this kind of research is not Mars, but the Moon. And by the way, it's a lot cheaper to do this kind of research on the Moon than it is on Mars.
Oh, well, then I'm against that.
So,
need more funding.
Well, I mean, I've actually talked to NASA at both at JPL and in Houston saying, you know, let's shift gears from Mars to the Moon. We have a much better chance of success, and it's a lot cheaper to do this research. But it's also interesting in that there are risky predictions being made all across the creation evolution spectrum on Earth's first life. You know, the model that we propose at Reasons to Believe is that Earth's first life would prove to be abundant. There's actually good chemical isotope evidence for that. What we don't have, though, is any evidence how big this life is. But in the model we've developed, it's one of God being aggressive and packing the Earth with as much life, with as much diversity for as long as possible in order to give humanity the maximum biodeposits for launching and sustaining civilization. If that model is correct, and by the way, it's not the only biblical model. There are other models that compete with ours that wouldn't require this. But from our perspective, we're suggesting that the fossils of Earth's first life will prove to be relatively large, say 1 to 10 microns, as opposed to a tenth of a micron, that it'd be fairly complex life, including even life that contains upwards of 1, 2, 3, or 4,000 gene products, and it would be diverse, not just one species, but many species. Now, the standard atheistic model for the origin of life is that the fossils of Earth's first life would be quite rare, not a huge abundance, but just a few, would be much smaller than bacterial life we see in the planet today, much simpler than the simplest bacterial life we see in the Earth today, and it'd be one species only. Hard enough from a naturalistic perspective to make one species, let alone two or three or four different species of life. So the point is, these are dramatically different predictions that are being made. And as I mentioned, there are other models that would be predicting things in between. Now, this slide demonstrates why we're never going to find the remains of Earth's first life on planet Earth. There's been aggressive plate tectonic activity that have been building mountains where there were plains. Moreover, we're seeing that there is aggressive erosion that's piling up material. Maybe we can turn off the lights here. You can actually see what I've got here. Let's see if we can do that. Let me pull this back one. And you can see what we're talking about here, heavy erosion and extreme plate tectonics, and that's why we don't have any evidence of Earth's fossils dating any earlier than 3.47 billion years ago. However, we do know that during that time, Earth was being bombarded by lots of asteroids, comets, and meteors, and huge amounts of Earth material were deposited on the Moon's surface between 3.5 and 3.8 billion years ago. How much? One paper was published calculating 20,000 tons of Earth's soil for every 100 square kilometers of the surface of the moon. That means the moon is carpeted with Earth material. Now, the NASA program of the 1970s was targeting pristine lunar material. Their goal was to bring back stuff that was lunar in origin, not terrestrial. What we're suggesting is let's go back to the moon and forget about the lunar material. Let's go after the Earth's soil. Let's recover that stuff. And one other thing that's interesting is, unlike Mars, papers have been published showing that the vast majority of the material transported from the Earth to Mars arrived via low-velocity, high-angle collision events, which means they're getting a soft landing. And because they're getting a soft landing, then there's a good chance that those fossils have not been destroyed. So,
why did the moon get low velocity and Mars get high velocity? Moon's closer.
Right. Well, it all has to do with the celestial mechanics. You know, the movement of the moon relative to the Earth, and you know, the trajectory that this Earth-transported material would take as it arrives on the moon. In fact, what you see is that when astronauts go to the moon, I mean, this is the Earth and this is the moon, they kind of take this kind of an orbital pathway. It's the easiest way to get to the moon. Well, also calculations have been showing that when a meteor hits the Earth, you're going to get more or less the same kind of trajectory, which means they arrive on the surface of the moon at a relatively low velocity, high attack angle, which means soft arrival, soft collision events, as opposed to Mars, where you're more likely to get a head-on high-velocity collision. This is all based on the celestial mechanics.
I'll recalculate that today.
So yeah, you can recalculate that today. It's a fun exercise.
Does the low moon gravity have something to do with that?
Well, you know, to give you the full story, there were papers published 3 years ago where they were claiming that, you know, forget about the fossils of Earth's first life because it's all going to come in at high collision velocities, in which case they get destroyed as they arrive on the moon. But then a group of physicists said, okay, this isn't just a two-body problem where you look at the Earth and the moon. We need to take into account the gravitational attraction of the sun. And so they did a multi-body calculation where they took into account Jupiter, the Sun, the Moon, and the Earth, and by that means determined that the first paper was wrong when they concluded high collision arrival. They said it's low velocity collision arrival, in which case we have a very good chance of recovering pristine fossils of Earth's first life. So all we got to do is go there and collect the stuff up and begin to analyze it. So there's a real potential. And by the way, we don't have to send people. Machines can do this at relatively low cost. You know, go to the moon and you know, dig the stuff up and bring it back to Earth, and then we can analyze it. Now, given NASA, they'll probably send people instead, but anyway, that's still cheaper than sending them to Mars. And we do know that we can send people to the moon and get them back alive. We have no assurance whatsoever that we can send people to Mars and bring them back alive. In fact, there was a research paper published by Arizona State University by a team of astronomers there where they said, let's call for volunteers to go to Mars permanently. In other words, we give them a one-way ticket to Mars. So,
I got a good
name
for you.
I know. As soon as they published that, everybody bombarded them with a number of politicians that they wanted to send on that one-way trip. So, we're getting close to out of time, but I'll take a question here.
I was watching an episode of The Universe. They had moon mysteries, and they were talking about these weird phenomena that have been seen on the moon. It's kind of like these lights, and they think
right.
It might be like gassing, outgassing. Could that maybe come from some kind of biological?
Yeah, that story comes up quite frequently, that you know, Mars might actually have volcanic gases being released. On the moon, pardon me, the moon, yeah. It's been disputed. There is no concrete evidence that that's actually taking place. Some have been attributed to optical defects. I mean, whenever you're looking at something through a lens or a set of mirrors, you will get ghost images. So some of that's been discounted on that basis. And it's not a phenomenon that's seen very often. Nevertheless, there are people speculating that maybe comets are delivering frozen water to the moon. If they do deliver it at the poles, it will stay in a frozen state, and that gets hit again, then you'd expect that kind of phenomenon. So the serious research about the outgassing on the moon is not claiming that it's indigenous. It's stuff that got transported to the moon, but because it landed in a place where the sun doesn't shine, it doesn't immediately evaporate. But if it gets hit, then it would spray up and get evaporated. So if it's not a ghost image and if it's real, then that's what we're dealing with.
No, I know. I was thinking of maybe like this light that got kicked up there from the Earth, that kind of like that broke down, you know, and created that gas.
Mm-hmm. Well, keep in mind that we're not talking, when I say it's easy to recover this life on the moon, and that's relative. Relative how difficult it would be on Mars. I mean, you know, think 20,000 tons per 100 square kilometers, that's still not a lot of Earth material. It's a very, be a very thin layer, and we're not saying it's evenly distributed. There are probably places on Mars where you're going to have a lot more, and other places on Mars where you're going to have none at all. So I'm not saying it's easy to recover this stuff, but it's definitely possible given current technology. And keep in mind, today, a ton of Earth soil contains 10 to the 17 bacteria. So if life was that abundant on Earth that many years ago, and that'd be interesting to find out, how abundant was life on Earth for 3.8 billion years ago? Last question, then we're going to close.
Just a quick update. It was a little over a year ago I gave a report on NASA's program to return to the moon. It's called Orion. And just a little over a year ago, the Clinton administration canceled that program. So we currently have no plans to go to the moon now.
We have no plans to go to the moon. They're still talking about going to Mars.
Orion made a large capsule that looked a lot like the Apollo mission, but just on a larger scale. And it was under development, you know, and had prototype capsules and stuff, but a year ago that program was canceled. And the current administration is asking for the private industry to come up with a vehicle to go there instead of NASA.
Right.
There is no matter of fact, the last shuttle, of course, landed, so we actually currently now have no manned space program at all in the United States.
Yeah, but what I've heard from my friends at NASA is there actually is a program to build a heavy launch vehicle like the Saturn V5. So if that's the case, it could always be used to do some significant stuff to Mars. And by the way, if we send machines rather than people, we can do it with current NASA assets. So it doesn't require coming up with all this stuff. And by the way, the Chinese are on record as saying, we're going to go to the moon. And so the Chinese may solve this problem for us. So let's bow. Father in heaven, we thank you that we live in such an exciting day when this kind of amazing research is not only possible, but is actually being undertaken. And Lord, we pray that you would grant the people that are studying this latest find in this carbonaceous meteorite, Lord, that you give them wisdom and care in dealing with this. Lord, we could come up with some concrete conclusions in less than, say, the 2 years it took for ALH84001. And Lord, we ask too that you would give researchers both on the Earth and those working on the Moon and elsewhere in the solar system insight and wisdom that we could learn more about exactly what your hand of creativity did on the Earth 3.83 billion years ago or perhaps even earlier. In Jesus' name, amen.
Sure. Have you found a correlation between the dispersion of man and...